just ain't so. And if we think we know what war is about because this news coverage is telling us, then it's a double whammy, because there are inherent limits to what journalism can convey about it's what it's really like to be in a war. War is about death. It's about terror. It's about maiming. And yet, in our news coverage, there's very little of that actually conveyed. And then another part of the invisibility in terms of the war on Gaza is that there's so much ethnic, religious, racial, and nationalistic bias that comes through. We've seen again and again how the Israelis who have suffered from Hamas's attacks, they have been really treated with great empathy, as they should be. But it's relatively rare to have a personal kind of bit of coverage in terms of what Palestinian people are going through. And in terms of the title and subtitle of the book, I eventually got a handle on how War Made Invisible applies to what has been going on in Gaza. But then I thought about the subtitle, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. And it became clear to me that the Israeli military is part of the U.S. military machine. There is a separate command structure, but more than ever, we've seen since October of 2023 that the so-called Defense Department of the United States and the so-called Israel Defense Force are really operating in an integrated way. And I think that's very important because, again, militarism is so ubiquitous and pervasive in U.S. society at so many levels, politically, economically, psychologically, in terms of media, in terms of adulation of the U.S. military. And that really has bled over and merged into the adulation given to the Israelis as supposedly fighting for a democracy in the Middle East. How can you have democracy when, as B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch have been documenting for years, that Israel is an apartheid state? So how can you have an apartheid state and still call it a democracy? One of the sort of gotcha questions that U.S. news media have been using very much during the war on Gaza is, do you think Israel has a right to exist? And we're all supposed to say yes. And my answer is, did apartheid South Africa have a right to exist? Does apartheid Israel have a right to exist? Or if we're going to have a single standard of human rights, should we not be calling for a country that is truly respectful of all human beings, rather than in practice, as Israel is doing, proceed as though some human beings are expendable?
Norman Solomon, you've written a very important book. People should get this book and read it, War Made Invisible. How can people get the book, and how can people follow your work?
A very easy way is just to go to the web, warmadeinvisible.org, and there'll be a lot of information there about the book. And also, my writing is on my website at normansolomon.com.
Well, Norman, once again, here on Law and Disorder, you've provided us with some information that certainly folks are not hearing on the mainstream media. And we thank you so much for bringing that untold story to all of our listeners.
Thanks a lot.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges about his book, American Fascists. Is there still time to halt the growing fascistic movement in America and preserve a meaningful measure of our threatened democracy? Next, we look at what has happened to those nearly 800 men and boys who for over two decades now have been locked away in Guantanamo Bay prison. Wrongfully denied prisoner of war status, tortured and denied any meaningful due process, 30 of them still remain with no clear idea of when their fates will finally be decided.
Stay with us.
I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The rise of Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters has transformed American politics, perhaps more than anything has since the gathering of forces of the rebellious slave owners in the South a century and a half ago. His first 4 years in office were chaotic, uninformed programmatically, and not animated by any kind of cadre of capable administrators. It was instead full of his statements and actions that many critics deemed to be racist, sexist, and xenophobic. He lost the election in 2020, although he did receive 74 million votes. And as he runs for the presidency again, this time he is talking, well, rather openly about wanting dictatorial authority, if indeed he is elected. And this time, if he does win, he now also has the aid of the right-wing Heritage Foundation, which has produced that 900-page Project 2025 document on how to radically change our country so as to make it far, far more conservative, provide far fewer rights to the American people, and allow any president so inclined to run the country as a virtual dictator. He has the financial support of a number of billionaires. He has an authoritarian right-wing Supreme Court, which in its latest decision, aptly named Donald Trump versus the United States of America, has given the presidency carte blanche immunity and placed him above the law, allowing the president to do almost anything he or she might want to do as long as it's deemed to be an official presidential act. And so today's program is the lead-off to a series of shows about fascism. Experts will discuss what it is, how it can be resisted, and how one organizes to make that resistance meaningful. We're going to start this series with today's guest, who is Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges is a wise and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a moral and political philosopher as well. He has written a book entitled American Fascism. So we will ask Chris how he defines American fascism and, again, how we can fight against it to be sure that we can save our troubled democracy. Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, you covered the Christian right for 2 years and wrote a book titled American Fascists. Who were these American fascists that you were identifying? Did Christian nationalism play a part in this? Talk to us about that.
So let me go back a little bit. I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother was a professor, but a seminary graduate. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, so I am steeped in the Bible. I have biblical literacy. I understand the church, how it works. And in my last year at Harvard, I had a tutorial. This was with an emeritus professor named James Luther Adams. It was kind of built on the British system where he would take two final year students and work with them. And he had been in Germany at the University of Heidelberg. He was bilingual in German in 1935 and 1936. He'd actually been in the lecture hall with Heidegger giving the Nazi salute. So don't let anyone ever tell you that Heidegger didn't begin his lectures that way. And he dropped out of the university and joined the underground confessing church. That was the church run by Niemöller, Karl Barth, Albert Schweitzer. They called out the traditional mainstream church for not denouncing fascism, but they also watched the rise of the so-called German Christian church, which was pro-Nazi. And Adams, so this was in the early 1980s, saw in the rise of the Christian right, Christian nationalism in the United States, echoes of that so-called German Christian church, which was fascist, which had the Nazi flag on one side of the altar and the German flag on the other, or the Christian flag or whatever it was. So he was the first person to call these people Christian fascists. He was 80 years old when I had him, and I remember him saying to me that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. These are heretics. These are people who have sacralized the worst elements of white supremacy, American capitalism, American imperialism, by distorting the biblical message. That was a very, the book now is, I think, 18 years old or something. It was a very unpopular position to take at the time, because the liberal church was attempting to engage in dialogue with these figures like Falwell and others. But of course, there was no real interest. In fact, one of my professors at Harvard invited Falwell to come speak, and I worked with the GBLT community at Harvard to shut down all the streets around the Kennedy School where he spoke. Well, it was all Falwell did was, in essence, flip the middle finger at Harvard while his cameras rolled. It was a great fundraising technique. He had no interest in dialogue at all. And this movement is what was one that was nascent. When I was a divinity student, I was overseas for 20 years, but I came back and it had exploded to the point where, of course, in many of the senior positions in the Trump administration were filled by these figures, Mike Pence, Barr, Betsy DuBois, and others. And it functions as any totalitarian movement functions. It engages in magical thinking. This Hannah Arendt argues that this is a fundamental element of all totalitarianism. It preys on the despair and alienation and even rage of its adherents. It's cultish, and Trump functions far more as a cult figure for his followers than as a political figure. It has all of the attributes. And when you look at studies of fascism, like Robert Paxton's book, Anatomy of Fascism, or Fritz Stern's The Politics of Cultural Despair, or other books like that, they always talk about how fascism, when it rises, uses the familiar comforting symbols that are indigenous to the culture. So German fascism, which was grounded in Teutonic myths, didn't look like Italian fascism, which harkened back to ancient Rome. And as Paxton said, when fascism comes to America, it will be with mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and the Christian cross and the flag. And that's precisely what's happened. So that's what I spent 2 years on the book. I spent a lot of time with these people, which was the only way to fully understand them. But what I found fascinating, I was always upfront about who I was and where I came from. As soon as they knew that I had, or I was biblically literate, they never wanted to talk about the Bible with me. And the reason is because they don't know the Bible. They know those sections of it that they've been fed to buttress their ideology, but they don't really know it at all. And it is, all of these megachurches, these pastors who are often, when they're successful, millionaires and private jets and everything else, are cult figures. They can't be challenged. They are in direct contact with God. And Trump just became that figure writ large, in fact, to the detriment of many of the mega pastors, because they transferred that kind of localized authority or complete authority over their adherents to Trump. I saw it coming. I understood the danger of it. And I understood, I didn't predict a Trump, but I certainly predicted or saw the rise of a demagogue out of this movement. And that's precisely what happened.
And your book is now 18 years old, as you mentioned. But it seems to me, and so I want to ask you, what makes it so relevant today? Is it the Trump phenomena, the fact that now there is that phenomena, the Make America Great slogans and the Trumpism, cultism that goes with it? Talk to us about the relevancy of it today, more so. Should we be more alarmed today even than you were at 18 years ago?
Well, definitely we should be more alarmed, because these people are on the cusp of taking power. And a second Trump administration won't look like a first. It'll be far more vindictive. And Trump was just mercurial and impulsive and disorganized. That isn't going to happen this time. Well, I think it's an important book because it explains the pathology of the Christian right, why they do what they do. I mean, just a small example, I went to a Right to Life weekend in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And again, I know as a reporter, for many years for the New York Times, that you can't understand these movements unless you spend hours and hours on the ground talking to people who are involved in them. So this Right to Life weekend, there are about 400 women they asked at the beginning for all the post-abortive sisters to stand, and almost the whole room stood. And when I started doing interviews, it wasn't that they had had an abortion. Many of them had multiple abortions. And they would take these people off. They'd take them off for weekends, and they give them plastic dolls and tell them these are the children they've murdered, and they have to dress the doll and bathe the doll and name the doll, and at the end of the weekend beg for forgiveness and vow to fight the culture of death, which is us. You know, there was that insight into the manipulation of guilt and despair to essentially recruit people to fight against the secular humanist society. I mean, that's a window into the so-called right to life movement that you don't get if you don't spend time with them. I took a seminar in Missouri, a creationist seminar. So they were teaching teachers in Christian schools, quote unquote Christian schools, how to teach about creationism, about the creation, which is supposedly literally true from Genesis. Well, the problem is that according to the Bible, the sun or light is not created until the fourth day. So do you spend the first 4 days in complete and utter darkness? And the teacher said, well, tell the students that God created a temporary light. Well, that's not in the Bible. But it is in those kinds of details that you see the irrationality. The rapture is not in the Bible. It's not there. When you put that ideology under a microscope, when you look at it with those kinds of details, you see how frighteningly, you know, irrational it is, and how it is really about the perpetuation of magical thinking. And that I did walk away. The first chapter of the book is despair, because these people have been through it. They've lost their jobs. They've been evicted. I didn't put it in the book because it was anecdotal, but almost every woman that I interviewed had suffered sexual or domestic abuse, struggles with addictions, opioid addictions, alcoholism, gambling. And so that secular world almost destroyed them. And that engenders the rage against that world. So I was in an end times gathering with Tim LaHaye, who wrote this very popular series. And by the way, just on the New York Times bestseller list, they exclude quote-unquote Christian books because it's a genre. But if they didn't, those would be the top 10 best-selling books. Oh, they would all come out of Christian nationalism. And it was this blood-curdling, you know, very graphic description of people's heads exploding and blood gushing out of their eyes kind of stuff at the end time. So when the Armageddon comes and the Antichrist returns and et cetera, and, you know, which all prefaces supposedly the return of the Messiah. And I realized that these people really hate the world outside the walls of that church and want to see it destroyed. There's an apocalyptic vision there that is very, very frightening. When you look closely at their lives and what has happened to them, you understand why they feel that way. But it's very, at the conclusion of the book, is that either these people who have been marginalized and pushed aside, especially through deindustrialization, either they are reintegrated into American society or we are finished. That's how I conclude the book, which I still feel is true.
And you've made the point that there's been an advance of Christian nationalism since you wrote the book, a further advance, a further entrenchment of it in so many of the laws in this country, including in what's going on in the schools. Let's talk then and turn our conversation then to the question of, well, what does one do? How does one fight that growing fascistic nature of the American body politic? You wrote in your book that that what we lack at that time, what you called, I think, a countervailing force. What's an example of that, and how could we help create a more effective countervailing force?
We're not going to argue these people out of irrational belief. We're not going to argue them out of creationism or a narrative that is not based on verifiable fact or science. It isn't going to work. The only way is to give them the kind of economic, social stability that has plunged them into this kind of despair and seen them grasp at this kind of magical thinking in order to endure. And this is the common denominator for all forms of totalitarianism, including traditional fascism. It is built, I mean, this is the whole thesis of Fritz Stern. I knew Fritz Stern. He left Nazi Germany when he was 18 as a refugee, taught at Columbia. But this is the whole thesis of his book, The Politics of Cultural Despair. And also Hannah Arendt picks up on that theme. So we have to address the social pathologies that have pushed people into the arms of these very frightening figures. And we're not doing that. The Democratic Party is ignoring it. The mercenary nature of the healthcare system, the skyrocketing utilities, you know, in our towns and cities, which have been sold off to private interests, rising food prices, the wage stagnation, the refusal to raise the minimum wage significantly, the breaking of unions. These are the conditions that create fascist totalitarian movements, and we're ignoring them. In fact, of course, the Democratic Party tends to demonize those figures. Not that they're not potentially frightening, not that the movement is not frightening, it is, but it's not addressed. I mean, if you go back and look at Weimar Germany before the 1929 global crash, the Nazis were polling in the single digits, I don't know, 4% or something. Well, what happened after the 29 crash is that the Weimar government took out all sorts of loans, international loans, to keep the economy afloat, but they sacrificed the working class. They actually suspended employment insurance for millions of Germans. And of course, what happened is this thrust destitute, desperate Germans into the arms of fascist movements. You had a countervailing communist movement, largely in the urban centers, and you had strong unions. It was a different kind of social dynamic, and the Nazis, of course, as soon as they took power, set out to crush that opposition, which they did, unfortunately, successfully. But it's the same dynamic, and we're not addressing the root causes that cause people to embrace these figures and rally around these cult-like politicians like Trump. And honestly, if it wasn't Trump, it would be someone else. You know, I think too often the liberal class or liberals tend to demonize Trump as if Trump is the problem. Trump is the symptom. Trump is not the disease. And we're not addressing the disease. And that's the whole point of my book.
Yes. You're making it clear, I think, that we also then need a new independent movement or independent party, a new party of our own. Talk to us about that if we can't look to either of the capitalist parties for the relief that is needed if fascism is not to run the day. How do we go about doing that? It's difficult, certainly. Many people have tried this before. What is your own thinking on how we go about creating the kind of countervailing force to those two parties so as to prevent what is happening?
Well, the two parties have conspired ever since Ross Perot to essentially block independent and third-party candidates. They do that primarily through making ballot access almost impossible, and I know because I worked with Ralph Nader. I was Ralph Nader's speechwriter, so I saw what they did. Presidential campaigns cost $1 billion, and you're just denied media access. You're not permitted to participate in the debates. You're shut out. The media is a kind of echo chamber for the system. When they do talk about third-party figures, whether it's Nader, Jill Stein, Cornel West, anyone else, they ridicule them and demon if they get mentioned at all. So that. And Teresa Armato wrote a good book. The name of the book escapes me. She was Ralph's, she's quite a brilliant attorney in her own right, but she ran Ralph's campaign. But she wrote about all of the hurdles and impediments and obstacles that the two parties together put up to block any kind of third-party movement. And that has really hurt us tremendously. And that's by design. I think the other big issue are unions. And this is why you have Shama Sawant, the former socialist city councilwoman in Seattle, trying to build militant movements. I mean, the only power we have comes through organized entities, grassroots entities, but in particular organized labor, because the capacity to strike is the only capacity we have to essentially cripple the system and make the system begin to address our demands. So you have 11% of the workforce in the United States is unionized. I think 6% of that is in the public sector. When the railroad freight workers, when they threatened to strike, Biden invoked I think it's called the Railroad Act, I can't remember the exact name, to essentially make the strike illegal, which kind of throws the lie that he's the most pro-union president, you know, going. And so the mechanisms by which we once, including, I think, an independent and a free media, you go back and look at public broadcasting two, three, four decades ago, you could see figures like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and even Malcolm X. That's all gone because, of course, they've slashed the funding and the corporate donors keep both public radio and public television alive, and they have to cater to their donor class like every other news organization. So there's been, the media is atrophied. You know, the range of acceptable opinion is kind of narrowed from A to B, to steal a line from Dorothy Parker when she talked about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actor. The health of our democracy is dire. The mechanisms by which we could reform it and address injustices have essentially been shut down through corporate power. Sheldon Wolin, I cite him all the time, but he's important. In his book, Democracy Incorporated, elucidates that. He died a few years ago. And I did the last interview with him, which is on YouTube. It's 3 hours long. He taught at Berkeley, taught at Princeton, Cornell West mentor. But we've undergone a corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. And it's over. They've won. These people have deformed the system to create the most grotesque and pronounced inequality in American history. They have designed a system by which money is funneled upwards, including, of course, slashing tax rates for corporations. I think, a year or two ago, Amazon didn't pay any taxes. I think it actually got money back. And this rapacious billionaire class, these figures, $180, $200 billion these individuals are worth. So, I mean, you read Aristotle, and he said that when you have that kind of social inequality, your only two options are tyranny or revolution. And we're well on the road to tyranny in the guise of Christian fascism.
And in terms of then what is needed to prevent that, that's the question. And of course, it's no doubt, as you've just described, how difficult that fight back effort would be. Do you take any encouragement at all from the fact that, public opinion polling shows that the younger people in America today prefer, for example, a socialist economy as opposed to a capitalist economy? The changing demographics of the country itself and what sometimes that portends. Do you think that before America would become a fully embedded fascistic country, there is the expectation in your mind, or the hope in your mind, or the possibility at least in your mind, that that could be prevented?
The problem is that we've been disempowered. I mean, that goes all the way back to the McCarthyite smears. Ellen Schrecker wrote two good books on this. And they purged the American system. Cold War liberalism, of course, distorts the very notion of liberalism. We're not organized. I mean, I take hope in the consciousness, especially of the young, who have been, we know, completely abandoned by the system. I mean, they can't find work, meaningful work. They can't afford a house. They've been essentially pushed out of the system. So yes, there is a consciousness, but we have to build the kind of militant organizations that can begin to shut down and cripple the system. And we don't have them. And that's what worries me. So if you look at the 1930s, what happened in the United States economically and what happened in Europe was very similar, but the responses were very different. Why? Because we had powerful militant labor organizations in the U.S., along with an independent press, much of it driven by the Communist Party, which we've written out of U.S. history, largely, and it frightened the ruling elites. I mean, Roosevelt, FDR, said his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. And I've read his private correspondence to his brother, and there's a fascinating letter early on in the 30s where he said, we have to begin to address this, the poverty and the unemployment, otherwise we'll get revolution. That's his word. And of course, the specter of the 1917 revolution in Russia and the rise of the Bolsheviks terrifies the capitalist class. And so that's how that is the impetus, along with all sorts of, like the GM sit-down strikes and everything else, that pushes Roosevelt to create a government jobs program. 12 million people are employed, public works, the WPA, along with Social Security, along with the 8-hour workday. But it didn't come because of the kindness or goodness of the ruling class. It came because they're frightened, which is always how it works. And we have been effectively disarmed. We've been effectively, are the movements and organizations we had by which we could protect our own rights have essentially been taken from us. And that worries me. So without those countervailing forces, it becomes far easier for fascistic programs and entities, parties to achieve power. So yes, the consciousness is there, but we lack the organizational structures to pit power against power.
So therefore, what should we do? What can we do?
Rebuild them as fast as we can. And that means stepping outside the system. It means union organizing. It means refusing to participate. I mean, I covered Gaza, for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I cannot vote for anyone who supports genocide. I mean, I've lost friends. Others have disappeared. I just came back from the Middle East. I was there all summer. I speak Arabic, but I was doing a refresher course because I'm going to do my next book on Gaza with the cartoonist Joe Sacco. I have just too many Palestinian friends. I can't, in every way. So I think we have to draw red lines that we won't cross. If enough people step outside the system will begin to get worried and the system will begin to respond. But that's what we have to do.
Well, I was thinking of during Vietnam, and what it took was many, many years, of course, of the slow and then sometimes more rapid growth of a massive movement that finally made it basically impossible, along with the victories of the Vietnamese on the battlefield, of course, the Viet Cong on the battlefield, for the United States government to carry on that imperialist war.
People forget. I mean, the civil rights movement, when was the first? I think Rosa Parks was on the bus in, what was it, 1954? It takes, I just spent 14 years fighting for the freedom of Julian Assange, but it took 14 years.
Well, Chris Hedges, then, a final thought or two, and then how can people follow your work?
I think we have to regain the kind of militancy. Remember, we are now facing the rise of an extremist, I would call it fascistic movement that potentially could seize power with a Trump administration. Read the Heritage Foundation 2025. They're prepared this time around in a way they weren't during the last Trump administration. Clearly, Trump will come in with a vindictive agenda to dismantle any centers of power that don't pay complete fealty to his personality cult. I think that we have to begin to confront that militancy with a militancy of our own. That essentially means shutting the system down, because that is, we have the numbers. That is what we have the capacity to do. I visited the student encampments opposing the genocide at Columbia and Princeton. And these students they understand that this is more than the genocide. This is about creating a kind of global environment where the rule of law no longer matters, where a genocide becomes an acceptable weapon, especially with mass migrations because of the climate crisis and everything else. So we have to begin to see through the propaganda that is spewed out over the airwaves about a system that it no longer represents our interests, but serves the interests of the billionaire class and the military-industrial complex, as Karl Liebknecht, the great German socialist, said about the German military on the eve of World War I. He called them the enemy from within, the enemy within. And I think that kind of consciousness and that kind of organization is where hope lies. And on chrishedges.substack.com, I also have on YouTube a YouTube channel where I now do my show after being pushed out of the Real News for my frequent criticisms of Joe Biden and the Biden administration over the genocide in Gaza.
That's what happens when you're honest in America these days. Chris Hedges, I can't thank you enough, really. Thank you so much for your work, your wonderful work, and for taking time to join us here on Law and Disorder.
Not at all. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Once a front-page story, the U.S. prison on Guantanamo Bay is seldom in the news these days, or apparently on the minds of the American people. But it certainly should be, because the history and ongoing operation of Guantanamo Bay Prison, or Gitmo as it is often called, exposes the lie behind our claim to be a nation governed by the rule of law. condemned by Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and many other such groups, it is a permanent stain on the character of the American people. Since 2002, at the height of its operation, close to 800 captives from many different Muslim nations were held there under torturous conditions as suspects, rather than being classified as prisoners of war, which they clearly were, and thereby accorded all of the rights that they were entitled to as prisoners of war. The youngest was 13 years old. In fact, 21 of the detainees were children. All of the detainees were subjected to barbaric forms of torture. Some committed suicides. Hundreds were convicted in sham trials and in illegitimate military tribunals. Many, if not most, suspects clearly bore no responsibility for combat operations in the Muslim nations where we were waging war. Now, today, about 30 suspects remain in the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. 16 are cleared for release, but it has not yet been made clear to what country they can be released. 3 have not been charged, nor have they been cleared for release. And nobody can reasonably predict when, if ever, they will be freed. And in the latest shameful twist, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has now upended a plea deal for the 3 prisoners accused of plotting the 9/11 attacks. It would have allowed the men to plead guilty and be sentenced to life in prison. But instead, given Austin's intervention, they will now face the death penalty if they are tried and convicted. And so today we revisit the ongoing Gitmo scandal. Unfortunately, we have the perfect guest to bring us up to date on the scandal. He is Shane Katyal, a senior managing attorney of the Guantanamo Project at the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, where he has worked on several significant cases arising in the wake of 9/11, including the center's legal challenges to the indefinite detention of men at Guantanamo. Shane Katyal, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, Shane, before we turn to the latest bad news about Guantanamo, perhaps you should remind our listeners why, domestically and internationally, there's been so much criticism of both, well, the physical treatment of the prisoners there, as well as their lack of due process with respect to any so-called trials. In other words, give us the background. It's been so long since this has been properly in the news that our listeners may need a bit of a briefing on that.
Sure. Well, it's a big question, you know. So even before there was a Guantanamo, the first prisoners only got there, I think, in January 2002. Even a few months before that, the Bush administration issued a memo saying that it was going to try terrorism suspects in military courts rather than in civilian courts, right? That they were going to create some sort of abbreviated version of the real criminal process and throw everybody into that kind of alternate justice system, right? You know, at the time, not really that many people had been, you know, kind of detained, at least to the outside world's knowledge. And so it read a little bit like, you know, Bush's administration is staffed with a whole bunch of former Nixon administration people. These are folks who really hated the Warren Court reforms, you know, that created so many kind of new procedural due process protections for criminal defendants. And this is what they're really aiming at. But it's not going to be some, you know, sort of broader thing than that. They'll capture a few suspects, and instead of bringing them to federal court, like they brought the 1993 World Trade Center bombers in, you know, they'll try them. They'll try to try them in some alternate system. But then, you know, by the time people started, you know, being flown into Guantanamo in January 2002, it became clear that something different was happening, and that it wasn't really aimed at the kind of person who maybe before 9/11 would have been brought into federal court for a, you know, high profile criminal trial. Instead, it seemed like the U.S. was sweeping large numbers of people off the battlefields, not really even the battlefields, off the borders of Afghanistan, and then in various urban settings in Pakistan, just grabbing every Arab man that they could find, you know, people who looked very physically distinct from local Afghans or local Pakistanis, and paying huge bounties for them, and without really any individualized suspicion, just kind of shipping them all off to Guantanamo and hoping that, you know, eventually the interrogation process would sort out, you know, a few kernels of wheat from a huge amount of chaff, right? A military commission trial process isn't really appropriate for the vast majority of those people because, you know, the vast majority of them are going to be people you never should have picked up. Instead, what we saw is what really came to characterize Guantanamo. Instead of, you know, having some people who they charge and some people who they decide to release, which is what we always called for, the vast majority of detainees there were held for years and years and years in a kind of middle category, a group that the government didn't want to charge, but also didn't want to release. You know, these folks who were kind of being indefinitely detained for the scope of hostilities, in this case, not hostilities against, you know, North Vietnam or Nazi Germany, but instead hostilities against Al-Qaeda, against terrorism writ large, right? So in the indefinite war on terror, these folks were going to be held until that war is over, you know, on the model of prisoners of war in a conventional conflict between nations. But, you know, this was a conflict that never would have a well-defined end, right? So this was sort of an excuse for holding people perpetually without charging them at all. You know, on top of it, they held them under conditions of great, great secrecy at Guantanamo, where lawyers weren't allowed to go in until we won the first case in the Supreme Court in the middle of 2004. So, you know, what did they do with those 2 years of kind of, you know, unmonitored access to the detainees? They tortured them. You know, whenever you sweep up 780 men on broad profiling criteria, like this guy was Arab in Afghanistan, you know, it's like arresting people for driving while black. You send them 8,000 miles away, put them in a room with a bunch of 25-year-old rookie interrogators that you've just trained for a few weeks. And when all the guys say, you know, I was just, you know, there as a refugee, I was fleeing the war, I had no intention of fighting against the United States, I just happened to be there after 9/11, right? The same story over and over again, you know, the interrogators start getting told, well, the problem is you aren't squeezing hard enough. And so that created the perfect conditions for what we saw, you know, a wall of secrecy wrapped around a torture camp full of people who, you know, we never really had any intention or evidence befitting charging them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we also did not categorize them as we should have. I mean, they were clearly prisoners of war. Whether they were guilty of any war crimes or war actions is a different matter, but they were prisoners of war. But, and by not categorizing them as such, that opened the door, did it not, to deny them, really, anything we would think of as due process in terms of guilt or innocence.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, the same Bush administration lawyers who wrote the torture memos, you know, rationalizing the use of torture on these guys also, you know, came up with this notion of their status that borrowed the most administration favorable features from the prisoner war regime and from the criminal regime, right? So, you know, for instance, prisoners of war are supposed to be held in barracks, right? Like Hogan's Heroes, right? They're not supposed to be held in solitary confinement. But if you're trying to interrogate the hell out of people, you hold them in solitary in order to break their psyche, right? You know, just to give one example, these guys were cut off from correspondence by and large with their families, often cut off from the Red Cross, right? All those are things that are safeguards for prisoners of war. And just generally, fighting on the battlefield for Nazi Germany isn't a crime, right? If you're detained, you can be held until the war ends in order to keep you from rejoining the hostilities. Once the war is over and a peace treaty is negotiated, you get shipped back unless you violated the laws of war in the way that you were conducting combat, right? If you shot Allied prisoners or killed civilians or something like that, right? So if these people were genuinely captured on the battlefield fighting with the Taliban against our allies and our forces in Afghanistan, you know, sure, you could hold them as prisoners of war until the conflict was over, but you can't hold them in punitive conditions. And, you know, you definitely can't hold them in sort of the torturous conditions that we had at Guantanamo in those early years. But, you know, maybe a bigger point is almost all of these people weren't captured on anything resembling a battlefield, right? Afghanistan was full of political dissidents, people with drug addictions, people with family problems who left their homes all over the Arab world and went there because you could get in without a visa and it was very cheap to live there. And occasionally there were, you know, Libyan dissident communities and Egyptian dissident communities and so forth that you could fall in with. These folks weren't even fighting on the front lines with the Taliban against the Northern Alliance before 9/11, although, you know, there certainly were some folks like that. The main point is, you know, once 9/11 happened and it was clear the U.S. was going to be involved, the vast majority of those foreigners fled for the hills and tried to get back home, right? You know, more people were arrested in Pakistan and brought to Guantanamo than were picked up in Afghanistan. And most of the people picked up in Afghanistan were picked up at the borders trying to get away. So even on the military's own accounts in their first kind of combatant status review tribunals in 2004, even on the military's own story, only about 8% of the people that they reviewed at that time were alleged to have been captured on the battlefield. And even those numbers are probably a little bit high. vast majority of people picked up in some kind of civilian context, and, you know, suspected of being, you know, fighters on the other side because of their foreign status.
All right. Well, now let's try to take a look at what happened to those nearly 800 prisoners, men and boys. So talk to us about that. In other words, there are only 30 left now, and we'll get to those 30 in a little bit. But of the other nearly 800, where are they now? How were their cases disposed of or not? Where are they being held, if still held somewhere? Talk to us about that large group that finally, after more than two decades, is not there anymore.
Yeah, so we can work backwards. So there's 780 men and boys held there over the years, only 30 left. One was brought to the United States, tried, and received a life sentence for the East Africa embassy bombings, probably the only person at Guantanamo ever tried in federal civilian court. Nine went home in coffins, and then the other 740 all either went home, or in the case of about a little less than 100 of them, I think, were sent to third countries as refugees. So, you know, I had a Libyan client who was, you know, cleared for release, clearly a nobody, was, you know, a mental illness case rather than a fighter. You know, they didn't want to send him back to Gaddafi's Libya in 2010 before the Arab Spring overthrew that autocratic regime. So they sent him to Albania, essentially, to get asylum there. There were a whole host of people like that. An awful lot of them are Yemenis. Yemenis were almost the most numerous nationality at Guantanamo, somewhere around 120 plus, I think. For whatever combination of reasons, the U.S. hasn't viewed Yemen as either having the political will or the actual capacity to monitor people closely once they're sent home. And that's kind of an absolute condition for sending anybody out of Guantanamo, even if there's no evidence against them, even if they were very clearly kind of picked up wrongly. The U.S. in almost every case insists that they be watched kind of for life, that they don't get a passport for at least 2 years, that the police check in on them and send back reports and so forth. So, you know, those 740 guys, whether they're at home with family or, you know, in some third country like a fish out of water, you know, they know that they're being watched still. And for a lot of them, the experience feels, you know, like prison in perpetuity.
Shane, what was the excuse that the United States government used for keeping so many of them against whom they never actually did bring charges? Well, you know, many of them were there for years and years and years, having been shown to be guilty of nothing. And then, as you say, returned in conditions which are disoriented and so forth. What was the rationale or excuse the U.S. government used to justify that? Basically, they were holding hundreds of people without charges for, in some cases, nearly two decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, for the vast majority of those 740, the allegations kind of roughly look like, you know, you had some social associations that make us think that you were a foreign fighter and that you were allied with the Taliban. And we think that, you know, you were probably involved even after we, the United States, got involved after 9/11, right? So sometimes, you know, they'll claim that various individuals were seen at one of these big military training camps, you know, where people would go for all sorts of reasons. Rich Saudis would go to get, you know, to pose with machine guns and show girls at home the pictures of them looking tough. Yemenis would go sometimes, poor Yemenis, and, you know, then sign up to fight on the front lines against the Northern Alliance and make $2,000 in a year so that they could go home and pay dowry and get married, right? The whole gamut. There's certainly a lot of cases like that. You know, but then there are also cases of guys like my, you know, schizophrenic Libyan who just lived in a house, kind of a guest house, a flop house with a whole bunch of other Libyan expats, right? You know, none of those folks were genuinely fighters, but the government might come in and say, well, one of them fought or one of them was at a training camp and you all were staying with that guy. So we think by association, you were also a fighter, right? And then they would say, well, that's enough because, you know, the war against the Taliban is also the war against Al-Qaeda, which is also the war against terror, which never ends. So, you know, we can hold you until the end of the war on terror because you stayed at this house with somebody who looked like a fighter, right? Then when you dig through that as a lawyer sitting in the little secret classified information facility down in Washington, D.C., looking at the government's actual allegations, oftentimes, I mean, really almost every time, the allegations don't come from some sort of reliable extrinsic evidence. They come from another detainee. You know, the government would be squeezing all of these guys under horrible conditions, interrogating people nonstop. A few of the smart ones would figure out, hey, you know, I can get out of solitary confinement. I can get real food. I can get a PlayStation. I can get released. if I just point the finger at everybody else here. And so there were a number of kind of mass accusers. The best documented one, the Washington Post said, pointed the finger at over 120 fellow detainees. And they'll take that guy's, you know, claims that I saw this person at Tora Bora, or I saw this guy in the next cell at a training camp, and use those as kind of the definitive evidence that you were a fighter in this never-ending war on terror. And that was enough, you know. And the problem is, you know, while the Supreme Court gave us two big victories in 2004 and 2008, the court right below them, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, was throughout the Bush and Obama administrations, really for almost that whole time, one of the most conservative courts in the country. And they did their best to make sure that we couldn't win a case based on the rules and procedures that they set up for fighting against that kind of hearsay evidence from other detainees.
Let's talk now about a recent development with respect to some, three in fact, of the 30 that are left. What was it has happened? The three that I'm speaking of course, are the three prisoners who were accused of having plotted the attacks of 9/11. There had been a plea agreement worked out whereby they would plead guilty, but their punishment would be life in prison. And then along comes Secretary of Defense Austin, and what does he do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So for context, you know, 30 guys are left. Only 11 of them are either charged or convicted by military commissions, including five guys who are, you know, alleged to have been at the core of the 9/11 conspiracy, the planning and logistics work of it. So the men you're talking about are three of those five. You know, the highest profile prisoners at Guantanamo, although they weren't, you know, there for the first couple years that we were litigating the case, rather they were moved there in 2006 out of the CIA's Black Site program, where they were horribly tortured. You know, the waterboarding cases that you read about, you know, one of those men was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's one of these three who tried to plead guilty, you know, waterboarded, I think, close to 100 times, maybe more than that, in CIA Black Sites. Now, you know, we know from his confessions to an Al Jazeera journalist a year before he was captured that KSM did, in fact, plan the 9/11 attacks. You know, probably, you know, the most culpable individual at Guantanamo. That's part of the reason he was brought to Guantanamo, in order to tar all the other prisoners there by association. You know, now every newspaper story says, hey, the plotter of 9/11 is the mastermind, is one of these detainees, right? Makes everybody else look bad. But when you look at the other 19 prisoners, you know, putting aside the 11 who are charged, all but three of them are cleared for release, meaning every agency, the CIA, the FBI, and so forth, has unanimously agreed that they can be safely released. So, you know, we are kind of now almost at that point where they've made the decision of either charge or release for all the men who are left at Guantanamo. And it's just a political challenge to get other countries to take, you know, the 16 guys who were cleared and the three guys who are just kind of waiting to be cleared, right? So what about the 11 cases, right? Well, after Eric Holder tried to bring the 9/11 defendants to New York to put them on trial for 9/11, the Republicans demagogued the issue. Mayor Bloomberg bizarrely raised some questions about shutting down Lower Manhattan for such a trial, and the whole thing kind of fell apart due to politics. Or as Holder said this week, due to political hacks on the other side standing in the way of it. But, you know, if they had been brought here, you know, they probably all would have been sentenced to death and the cases would have been over a long, long time ago. Instead, they were charged in military commission in 2008, and those cases, 15, 16 years later, are no closer to a resolution than they were at the outset. The commission system is an incredibly complicated system being created from scratch. Imagine having to recreate all 240 years of federal criminal law from the get-go in a system where the judges rotate out every 2 years, which is how the military system works. You know, it just hasn't gotten off the starting blocks. So, you know, albeit that these guys were charged with the death penalty for the most serious crime maybe in American history, they were never going to get to the death penalty, right? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is 56 years old. It would take, you know, 5 to 10 years to get a trial started. Then after that, 5 more years after a verdict. They were tortured horribly. There's always a chance that the military jury might issue clemency and give them life instead of death. So the prosecutors for a long time have kind of understood we're just, from a number of standpoints, never going to get to the death penalty here. So what we ought to do is trade off the possibility of the death penalty in exchange for a voluntary guilty plea, right? Which is what they have been working on for years. And probably the only way that those remaining 10 or so charge cases are ever going to get resolved, not through trials, but through plea bargains, right? The convening authority, the brigadier general who's in charge of the whole military commission process, agreed a couple weeks ago to accept the plea bargains of three of these men. You know, the deal was they will plead guilty, they will get life instead of death, and they will agree to answer questions from the victim's family members, which was a huge, huge point. The victim family members really want to know about the motivation for why they did the attacks, but also, maybe more importantly, the financing, which is one of the bigger remaining mysteries. So it was a deal that benefited everybody. You know, unfortunately, the same people who demagogued bringing these people to the United States for a quick federal criminal trial, you know, came back out, you know, Tom Cotton, Lindsey Graham, et cetera, saying this is weak. You know, we're trading off the death penalty for guys who surely deserve it more than anybody else who's ever received the death penalty in the United States, right? The Secretary of Defense, who nominally, you know, ranks above the convening authority, the Brigadier General, who signed off on these deals. Secretary Austin came back from an international trip where he allegedly was, you know, very busy dealing with, you know, Ukraine and Gaza and just didn't have the time to pay attention to these ongoing plea negotiations. He came back and he withdrew or claimed to withdraw the plea negotiations or the plea deal, right? Now, there's going to be a huge amount of litigation about whether or not what he did is even legal, right? Usually when you've got a signed deal, unless one side committed fraud, basically, I mean, there are very narrow grounds under which you can withdraw out of the deal, right? And these guys allegedly signed off on a big factual proffer saying, I did X, Y, and Z, right? And it's very hard to walk back from that. So I think there's going to be some legal dispute over whether or not what Secretary Austin did even can have any effect, you know. And then beyond that, there's a big question about whether it is what's called unlawful command influence. You know, the military doesn't have standing courts. They have convening authorities who create a judge and a court for the purpose of every individual court martial. And that's what's happening in these military commissions as well as in any other military trial in the U.S. But the convening authority is supposed to be relatively independent of their boss, you know, the Secretary of Defense. Right? These were kind of Vietnam War era modifications to make the system resemble an objective system of justice like the civilian criminal system. They've been codified in statute in the Uniform Code of Military Justice and then in the Military Commissions Act for Guantanamo. If what Austin did was unlawful command influence, and the remedy is usually dismissal of the charges, and then we're right back to square one, right back to where these cases were in 2008.
Shane, looking back on all of this now, and of course it's not over yet, and I guess no one can predict when it will be over. All sorts of international human rights bodies have condemned what the United States has done at Guantanamo. All those horrid pictures of the torture that was going on that were in the news media in this country off and on for years. The continuing keeping of prisoners after 21 years now or whatever it's been. What do you think was the political motivation for acting in that way? How did that really serve the interest of the United States? So talk to us briefly about that, if you could. And then also, before we have to say goodbye to you, please let our listeners know where they can find out more about your work and the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights on Guantanamo.
Sure. Well, in terms of, you know, political motivations, the kind of pattern I described at the outset where, you know, the government gets caught off guard by the 9/11 attacks, law enforcement and the intel agencies have been surprised. They get a little grace period, but pretty soon people are going to be asking questions about how they got caught so wrong-footed, right? So, you know, the traditional response of police and intel agencies in that kind of circumstance is to sweep in a huge number of suspects using profiling criteria. You know, here it was Arabs in Afghanistan, right? You sweep them in, you know, notwithstanding that you know that most of them are going to be false positives, most of them are going to be mistakes that you shouldn't have picked up in the first place, but you throw them behind a big veil of secrecy in prison, and then you can point to them and say to the public, hey, we have 600 suspected terrorists, or, you know, in the domestic immigration sweeps, we have 1,200, you know, people who were here, you know, illegally, who we suspect maybe of some involvement in the 9/11 attacks, right? When in fact, it's just their nationality and religion, right? So politically, it's very convenient in that way. We know it doesn't work well. You know, it's been done since, you know, the 1920s Palmer raids, the Japanese American internment, right? You name your example, right? Of mass detention created by profiling. You know, we know it doesn't work, but we do it anyway because it's politically convenient. You know, another thing that we know doesn't work to get accurate information is torture. But it somehow seems more executive for the president and the administration to be engaging in torture. You know, in the Bush administration repeatedly did things that were, you know, obviously illegal and then made the political case that the Democrats aren't willing to break the law to keep you safe, right? Now, that glosses over whether or not torture works and whether it keeps us safe, whether it's an accurate way of discerning the truth from detainees. We know from 800 years of history with judicial torture that it isn't. But people are willing to believe that it is when they hear about it for 5 seconds in a soundbite on TV or in a newspaper, right? So again, very politically convenient. You know, you see this sort of thing with their surveillance practices, right? Yeah, we broke the law, but, you know, we're the only ones who are willing to do that. And again, it fits perfectly with this kind of, you know, Nixon kind of administration retread kind of, you know, reaction to the perceived excesses and criminal defense rights of the Warren Court of the 1960s, right? That, I think, is the 5 cent version of why it's, you know, it's popular, you know. And I remember in 2008, you know, seeing survey data that showed that evangelicals in particular approved of torture because they saw it as kind of fitting punishment. So the idea that, you know, we tortured innocent people, that's how you kind of crack through that veneer. But to torture somebody like KSM, it just doesn't bother a huge chunk of the other side's core electorate. So yeah, all sorts of ways in which it's a political positive, which is why it gets done, even though we know from a national security standpoint, it isn't, right? You know, General Taguba told Congress years ago that the number one and two causes of battlefield deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan of American soldiers were respectively the symbols of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, right? And you see ISIS, even a couple of years ago, dressing up its civilian prisoners in Guantanamo orange jumpsuits, right? It's a sign of how potent the symbolism of this place is, a symbol of America's imperial ambitions in the Arab world and our hatred of Muslims, right? It's a symbol of all those things. And that's not a positive for our national security in any way you think about it. In terms of, you know, how you can learn more about it, we've got a website, you know, just Google Center for Constitutional Rights. All of us on the Gitmo staff have active Twitter accounts. You can follow us there. Just look for my last name, Katadal. You'll see my ill-tempered musings on Elon Musk's site. Those are places to start. And I'm sure you can, you know, from there go on. I should mention Carol Rosenberg, the exceptional reporter from The New York Times, has a terrific Twitter feed as well as her regular articles in The Times. The person who has seen more and covered more and exposed more about Guantanamo than really anybody else on the planet.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you for a wonderful interview and for a very enlightening one, I assure you. Shane Katadal, we thank you for joining us today here on Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me back.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. What a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's something you co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drummer world misses a wonderful influence on them as he